Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is September 6, 2009, here on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. There's probably no issue that's more dominant in the news today than healthcare and what's going to happen with the health system in the United States. Our guest today is going to be one of the real experts on the matter who can get behind what's going on with the political and media fights over healthcare. Wendell Potter joining us today live on the program. But before we go to Mr. Potter, first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
After Glenn Beck of Fox News called President Barack Obama a racist and claimed that the president had a, quote, deep-seated hatred of white people, the nonprofit organization Color of Change began calling on advertisers to stop airing their commercials on Beck's show. As of this writing, 57 advertisers have pulled their ads, including Geico, Procter & Gamble, Applebee's, and General Mills. Danny McLean is the campaign manager for Color of Change.
What's troubling is that Glenn Beck presents himself as a journalist. You know, he has this show on Fox News Network, ostensibly a news outlet. And I think what was just so over the top about his comments about President Obama was it has no basis in fact. You know, usually we expect commentary or news analysis to be based on some reported actual news, something that has a basis in fact, and that's just not the case here.
The problem goes deeper than a single remark, says McLean, pointing to Beck's pattern of fear-mongering and scapegoating. And she says that type of rhetoric may be more dangerous in troubled economic times.
People are facing foreclosure. People are going into bankruptcy because of sky-high health care costs. And there are a lot of Americans that are feeling very insecure and very afraid. And if they haven't yet quite gotten used to the fact that we have a black president, they are quick to scapegoat. And really, that's what Glenn Beck is doing, is trying to kind of whip up these racial fears.
Color of Change was founded in the wake of the poor government response to the devastation of Hurricane Katrina 4 years ago. What started out as a personal email list has grown into a force of more than 600,000 people across the country who are engaged in Gulf Coast recovery, police accountability, and media justice work. McLean emphasizes that Color of Change's campaigning is not an attempt to silence the right wing or curtail freedom of speech.
This campaign is very narrowly focused on Glenn Beck, and we really feel that Glenn Beck is the worst of the worst when it comes to these so-called pundits that have this privately funded, very large megaphone and use that platform to tell lies and then want to pass those lies off as journalism. These people who are trying to make this a free speech issue, that is so off the wall. You know, free speech provisions are about the government challenging someone's right to express their opinions, and that's not what's happening here. If people on the right want to say that we're trying to banish their perspective, that's incorrect, but we aren't going to stand by as someone consistently race baits and tries to whip up racial fears. We're not going to stand by quietly and take that.
For more information about Color of Change, go to colorofchange.org.
Late last week, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit threw out a Federal Communications Commission rule designed to protect consumers from media consolidation in the cable market. The rule had stated that a company could not own more than 30% of the total market nationwide. Corey Wright, policy counsel for Free Press, describes the history behind the ownership caps.
In 1992, Congress passed the Cable Act, which instructed the commission to ensure that consumers had access to competition and choice and diversity of programming. And they asked the commission to accomplish this by capping the number of subscribers that a single cable company could reach, basically a percentage of the market. In the decision that came down on Friday, the commission basically was told by the D.C. Circuit that its 30% cap was no good, and the court threw it out. And this is actually the second time that the court has done that.
The suit was brought against the FCC in 2007 by Comcast and the National Cable and Telecommunications Association. In last week's ruling, the court called the 30% cap arbitrary and capricious, and stated that it failed to consider other competitors to cable TV, like satellite providers. The court's decision came down as the agency was in the midst of its own annual review of video competition. Free Press filed comments last week with the FCC about the current state of competition in the cable market.
In spite of the fact that cable operators have increasing revenues, they're investing less in infrastructure that would improve the experience for consumers. And even though cable companies are seeing increased profits, consumers are seeing increased prices.
Despite the court's decision, the battle over diversity in the cable market is not over.
The FCC has to create a rule. It's been instructed by Congress to do it. The fact that the court threw it out doesn't mean that it gets to just ignore it and not pass some form of ownership cap. So they're going to either have to go back to the drawing board and create a new rule, or they may be considering asking the Supreme Court to review the D.C. Circuit's decision and maybe seeing what can happen in that venue.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you this September 6, 2009 at WILL, AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is someone who's been in the middle of the healthcare industry for nearly two decades, at the commanding heights of it in many instances, and who comes now as someone who's a critic of the industry and a proponent of healthcare reform. Wendell Potter was formerly the head of corporate communications for Cigna Insurance, and before that a journalist, and now he is the senior fellow in healthcare for the Center on Media and Democracy based in Madison, Wisconsin. Mr. Potter, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you, Bob.
You know, you've kind of gotten a lot of acclaim recently because you have such an interesting story to tell and a different perspective from almost anyone else who works on this issue. And for those of our listeners who are unfamiliar with you, and I suspect there are many who would fall in that camp, let's maybe talk a little bit about your background. What is Cigna? What did you do at Cigna? How long were you there?
Cigna is one of the it's a Fortune 500 company. It is one of the four largest health insurance companies in the United States, and it also has a very large international division. It, the last I checked, I've been away from the company for about a year now, a little over a year, insures in one health plan or another about 12 million people or so. I was head of corporate communications while I was there. My career stretched over 15 years at Cigna. The whole time I was there, I was in the legal and public affairs division and on the public affairs side of the house. And when I left, I was head of corporate communications, and I was a chief spokesman for the company and a member of the public policy council for the company.
What does corporate communications mean? Public relations, basically?
It does. Over the past several years, PR people have shied away from using the term PR in their titles. Almost everybody is now a communications corporate communications person or corporate relations person. Almost no one's a PR guy anymore.
PR, I guess, doesn't have such a great reputation. Corporate communications might be catching up, though.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, corporate communications is almost like a euphemism to replace public relations because it has a bad rep. And I think you're right. They're going to have to come up with something else, something new again pretty soon.
So what sort of work would you do with Cigna? What sort of problems would you have to sort of solve for them?
Well, I was a person who was on the front lines. I dealt with all the major media whenever there was a crisis or a quote high profile case involving a person who was insured by Cigna, and that happened fairly often. I was a person who dealt largely with the financial media, particularly during the last couple of years of my stay there. I was head of the financial communications unit. In other words, I was a person who, when the company announced earnings every 3 months, I communicated with and answered questions from the reporters who wrote stories for the Wall Street Journal and Dow Jones and Reuters and Bloomberg. So that was a large part of what I did. So consequently, I had to know a lot about how the company operates, how it makes money, and what it does to make sure that it meets Wall Street's expectations every 3 months.
Were you at Cigna when the Clinton administration tried in their first 2 years to get a major health care reform body of legislation passed?
I was. I actually was first, my first 4 years in the insurance industry, I was with Humana, which is another large insurance company that's based in Louisville, Kentucky. And I was there until 1993, and that was when the Clintons first began work on the health care plan that they eventually gave to Congress. And by 1994, I was very much involved in efforts while I was working at Cigna to do what one could do in the insurance industry to torpedo the Clinton plan.
Now, as I recall, and this is going back 15 years, the insurance industry did a tremendous job of demolishing the Clinton plan, although, again, the Clintons might have something to do with it. I don't know the details well enough to know the other players. Is that your sense, too?
Yes. The insurance industry played a very key and pivotal role in killing the plan. The insurance industry paid for the notorious, maybe infamous, Harry and Louise commercials from 1994, which featured a married couple that would sit around their kitchen table talking about health care reform and how worried they were about the massive Clinton plan that was being proposed and what it would mean to them and their taxes. So that is probably cited more often than not as one of the most effective advertising and PR campaigns that that there was during that time that turned people against reform.
And then I saw in another interview with you that one of your last areas of work before you left Cigna, if I'm not mistaken, was to work on the Sicko movie that Michael Moore released, I think, a little over 2 years ago on healthcare. Was that right?
That's right. That was in the movie came out in the United States. It was the premiere was, I think it was late May in France at the Cannes Music Festival. Movie festival, and the industry was anticipating that movie, had been for some time, and had been trying to get as much intelligence as possible about how Moore was going to be approaching the movie, how it would be done, and all of the PR people, I'm sure, in the industry, including me, made sure that our CEOs were media trained to anticipate an ambush interview by Michael Moore, which never happened. He didn't take that tack this time. He, as those who have seen the movie know, it was a documentary about how the U.S. system compares and contrasts with the healthcare systems in many of the other developed countries in the world. And one of the things that the industry did when it was apparent what he had done with his movie was to launch a very well-financed behind-the-scenes campaign to discredit Michael Moore as a documentary maker and to discredit the healthcare systems in the countries that were featured in the movie.
In the course of doing this work, did the healthcare industry come up with a lot of factual inaccuracies and bogus claims that Michael Moore was making that they could build their case on?
Yeah, what the industry does, and it has a set of so-called facts, but it's often misleading information about the healthcare systems abroad. Certainly, the Canadian system, the system in the UK and France, all of which were mentioned in the movie. The industry wants to scare people away from any system like those because those systems don't allow for-profit health insurance companies to have such a tight grip or even to exist. But certainly in this country, the for-profit industry pretty much controls our healthcare system in many, many ways, more than people realize. So a lot is at stake here. It has been for many years as the industry has shifted from one that was at one point dominated by nonprofit organizations to one that is now dominated by a very small number of very, very large for-profit companies.
Just one last point on the Michael Moore film, though. I mean, was the film itself, were there problems with the film that, you know, legitimate analysis of it found that there were deep flaws in it, or was it just a hatchet job that the industry was doing on the film?
No, the movie was not flawed. In fact, I not long ago was able to talk with one of the producers of the movie, and she was a fact checker, and they were very careful to make sure that they got their facts right, both about the anecdotes that they were telling about people who were not treated well in this country, as well as the systems abroad. It was a very factual documentary. Of course, Michael Moore, as most documentaries do, documentary makers do, they have a point of view, and certainly there was a point of view. But in terms of accuracy, it was an accurate movie. What the industry does is try to make people believe that people have, if people were to, if we were to have a system like Canada, for example, which is more like a Medicare for all system. In fact, they call the program Medicare up there. There are significant differences, but they would try to make people think that you have to wait a long time before you're able to see a primary care doctor or to get a test. So there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of lies that they disseminate about other systems to make people fearful of them, and they use the terms like government takeover of the healthcare system, or that if we were to enact healthcare reform, or were to consider a legislation that would create something approaching a Canadian system, we'd be heading down toward the slippery slope toward socialism. These are terms that the industry knows from years of focus group testing and use, going back to the days when they were successful in killing the Clinton plan. They know that those are emotion laden terms that scare people. So it's all a big part of their fear mongering campaigns that they launch, that they fund, and it's almost all done behind the scenes, so that it's hard to put or to connect the industry to those campaigns.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. Our guest today is Wendell Potter, formerly the head of corporate communications for Cigna, the huge health insurance company, presently now a senior fellow on healthcare for the Center on Media and Democracy based in Madison, Wisconsin. He's been very active in the healthcare debates this year, trying to draw attention to certain issues that might not get that much coverage. Why did you leave Cigna? When did you leave it? Were you run out of there once they realized that you weren't a true believer?
No, I left. It was a volunteer departure, in fact. I told the company leadership in January of 2007 that I wanted to leave, and turned in my resignation. They asked me to stay on three different times, and I agreed to do that. My last day was May the 2nd. We announced it as a retirement. I was 56, and at that time I didn't know exactly what I was going to be doing. I hadn't made any decision to speak out against the industry at that time, but I had grown increasingly concerned about the direction that the health insurance industry was going, and the kinds of policies that the insurance industry is trying to push us all into these days. It's ironic to me that a lot of our politicians, including our president, say that if you're in a health plan that you like, health care reform is not going to change that. You can stay in the plan that you like. It certainly won't be the government that forces you out of the plan that you're in. They're right about that last part, but it is the nation's insurance companies and people's employers that more than likely over the next coming months and years will be forcing people out of the plans that they're currently in, because the industry wants to get people herded into these high deductible plans that they euphemistically call consumer-directed plans. And it is one of the reasons I became increasingly concerned about these plans is because it shifts so much of the financial burden to individuals and families people are finding they have to pay several thousand dollars out of their own pockets before their insurance kicks in. And in a country that has a median household income of $50,000, and the premiums for a family of a family that has insurance through the workplace, the premiums, annual premiums, are about $12,600 now. The employee's percentage of those premiums is increasing year by year, and now the insurance industry wants to shift more of the financial burden by making people pay more out of their pockets before the insurance kicks in. That is a leading reason why we have this very big growing problem of the underinsured in this country, and that's going to continue. That was the main reason I decided to leave. That plus I was able to see from another role that I had in my job, which was a public affairs role. I worked with the America's Health Insurance Plans on a lot of different occasions, going back to the Clinton era, in developing strategic plans and carrying them out to try to kill reform or to fashion any legislation that might be proposed that would pertain to the industry in a way that would benefit the industry. So I was a part of that. I didn't want to be a part of it again.
If you could just elaborate, Wendell Potter, for a second, on how the health insurance industry has changed from the early 90s to today. You've talked about this rise of these new, pushing these new deductible plans. What other major changes have there been that consumers may not be aware of?
I don't think they're aware of the structure of these companies and how they've changed. Back in the 90s, the largest number of people were enrolled in nonprofit Blue Cross Blue Shield plans back then. I mean, Cigna certainly was around and Humana was around, but they were big companies, as was Aetna. By and large, the Blues dominated. And those Blues at that time were largely nonprofit. Since that time, there's a lot of the Blues have converted to for-profit status. Many of them have been bought up by WellPoint. WellPoint is now one of two very, very, very large health insurance companies. Its closest rival is United Healthcare, and they both, between them, insure about 60 million people. After that, you've got Aetna and Cigna. And then you drop down, you've got Humana and Coventry and Health Net. So you've got these very, very large insurance companies to the point that now there are about seven companies, insurance companies, all for profit, that dominate the industry. One out of every four Americans is now enrolled in a plan, one out of every three Americans is now enrolled in a plan that is managed by one of those seven companies. So you've got essentially a cartel of very, very big companies that are publicly traded. They're owned by investors. And the consequence of that, I don't think people realize the consequences and what that means. Every 3 months, a public company has to report earnings to investors. And investors look certainly at earnings per share. That's a measure they look at for any company. But in the health insurance industry, they look for something called the medical loss ratio. And in 1993, the medical loss ratio was about 95%. What I'm talking about here is that means that 95 cents out of every dollar, every premium dollar that an insurance company took in, it paid out in claims, or paid claims when people went to the doctor, went to the hospital, or picked up their medicines. Now it is down to about 80 cents, and it fluctuates sometimes above 80, sometimes below 80, on the average of these big companies. And that means that now just 80 cents of every dollar that we send to the insurance companies are paid out in claims. The remainder goes toward what they call administrative expenses to pay for advertising, sales, marketing, underwriting, executive compensation, profit. A large percentage of the dollar now goes to pay, to reward shareholders. So that is a big change, and it continues. There is constant pressure on these companies to make sure that every time they announce earnings, every quarter, that medical loss ratio does not inch up. The investors want to go the other direction. They want the insurers to pay less and less every quarter on medical claims.
Our guest today, Wendell Potter, who is now a senior fellow for the Center for Media and Democracy based in Madison, Wisconsin. Before that, spent 20 years in the corporate communications world, 15 of which was Cigna, the health insurance giant. We've been talking about his experience and his present work, which is going around publicizing how the industry actually works and the need for credible reform policies. And if you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Wendell Potter, the telephone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And just to sum up, if I understand what you're saying so far, Mr. Potter, the system we have now dominated by these health insurance companies is driven overwhelmingly for the pursuit of profit, if not exclusively, and isn't really reformable unless we really change the structure of the system.
You're right. A publicly owned company in this country, I mean, their number one objective has to be to enhance shareholder value. That's number one. That's why every company, particularly in the health insurance industry, but not just in health insurance, but in every industry, that is the number one goal. You've got to look after your investors and their investments in your company first.
Is there one simple solution, or what sort of solutions should we be considering? Leaving aside what is going on in Washington, which we'll talk about in the program in a moment, right now. But, I mean, just looking at this dispassionately, looking at the American healthcare system, what would be the sort of solutions that would get us a better healthcare system?
Well, going back to the movie Sicko, Michael Moore went to France, the UK, and to Canada, and I think Japan, and even to Cuba. And I think it was a mistake for him to go to Cuba because it became so easy for people on the right to attack that he went down there and distorted the message. But anyway, all these companies have achieved universal coverage, and they've done it in different ways. In Canada, they have more of a pure single-payer system in which the government is the sole insurer of its citizens. Now, healthcare is delivered privately, so it's a government-run program, but privately, the care is privately delivered by doctors in private practice and hospitals that are not owned and operated by the government. In other countries, they do allow insurance companies to operate, but they're much more regulated than they are here. And most of those countries, in fact, I think all of them, prohibit for-profit insurance companies from operating there. So there's not the profit motive that interferes with the financing of care in those countries. So there are a variety of ways that our country could look to achieve universal coverage. Taiwan is a recent example of a country that changed. It reformed its healthcare system. The officials there they looked at healthcare systems all around the world. They looked at the U.S. and in fact they looked at our Medicare system in particular, because it works for and has worked for many years for our senior citizens and those who are disabled, and they found a lot of the Medicare system here, the Medicare system in Canada they liked, and so that country fashioned its reform around healthcare systems here and in other countries, and it works. We should be doing the same thing.
So, in other words, there's a whole range of possible ways to solve the problem. There's not just one button you push.
That's right. Now, of course, the health insurance industry doesn't want this country to consider any of those. In fact, when you hear the expression, we need to have a uniquely American healthcare system, a lot of people say that, but it's certainly a mantra from the health insurance industry. They don't want anyone to even think about the U.S. looking abroad for a solution or for ideas. That is just code expression for, whatever we come up with has to be very much cooked up here in the United States, and the insurance industry, have the ability to influence the legislation and the creation of whatever reformed healthcare system we might wind up with.
And I don't want to belabor this point, but I think it's worth noting that, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, the sort of health insurance system we have in the United States today that's dominated the last generation or so is quite a recent phenomenon. Until the 1960s or 70s, these firms played very little role, or they were nonprofit.
That's right. And my first job in healthcare, I was head of public relations and advertising for an integrated, nonprofit integrated healthcare system in Knoxville, Tennessee. And it had a small HMO. Back during that time, we're talking about the late 80s, a lot of hospitals and doctors' networks were developing HMOs. There were a lot of HMOs around the country. That's kind of vanished from the landscape. But at that point, a lot of these small startup HMOs were created by nonprofit organizations from hospitals and provider organizations. Those were either ultimately pushed aside by the big guys. They no longer were able to compete, or they were acquired by the big guys. And that's how the industry has got to be as big as it is, or the big players as big as they are, because because of mergers and acquisitions over the years. They've grown largely that way. And that's very different from what it was just a few years ago.
Our guest, Wendell Potter. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney of WILL. The phone number, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Let's start with line one from Champaign County.
Hi, good afternoon. I wanted to ask you to comment on a few things. And the first off is California Nurses Association has just issued a report, and it's on California statistics, but I'm sure it's not terribly different other places. And the headline on their splash page, California real death panels, insurers deny 21% of claims. Your pharma organization, Cigna, is second to Pacific Care. They're one out of three. So overall, one out of five claims are denied by insurers. Cigna denies one out of three. That's in the first half of 2009. So that's really daunting. Aetna is down at 6% denials, and I assume that they're one of those gold-plated insurers. I don't know the specifics of it, but it's pretty amazing, and it's well worth people's attention. John Nichols, your friend Bob, has just highlighted Tammy Baldwin's actions in the House of Representatives to try to get a sense of the Congress vote, I guess it is, because an option for single payer is already in at least one of the bills that's stalled right now after Kucinich and a couple of other people's actions on that. So this actually, the idea of this, which is not maybe the best way to get to single payer, but it's how it happened in Canada, was actually championed by former Illinois Senator Simon in the improvements to the Health America Act. A Clinton bill was so summarily disposed of by the health industry that, or health insurance industry, that we don't even remember what it was called. So some comments on those two things. And then just locally here, there's a activist organization, Champaign County Healthcare Consumers, that have a community meeting this coming Thursday at 6:30 at the Champaign Library called a community meeting on national health reform. And no representatives that I know of are showing up, but that's something that people in the immediate area can use if they like to. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you very much for calling. Wendell Potter, your comments?
Yeah, I haven't seen the study that the California Nurses Association news release was based on. I've heard about it, I've seen it, and I'm not surprised that a lot of the big for-profit companies have a very high denial rate. It is one of the ways that the companies meet Wall Street's expectations, denying claims, going back. If a person buys insurance in the individual market, in other words, if a person is not eligible or for whatever reason does not buy or get insurance from the workplace, he or she has to buy it on their own. And you have to fill out an application and disclose whether or not you've had an illness in the past that the industry would consider a pre-existing condition. If you get sick and have high medical claims, then studies have shown, or investigations have recently revealed, that companies will go back and look at your application, looking for the possibility that you might have left something out, or inadvertently, or on purpose, fail to disclose something, and they'll cancel your policy. That's another way that they avoid paying claims. In fact, one congressional investigation found three companies had, over a recent period of time, canceled 20,000 policies, and that had saved those companies $300 million. So that's another way that they save money to Wall Street's benefit. And a third is to keep small employers from offering insurance. The number of small employers, or the percentage of small employers offering insurance, has dropped from 67% to 38% in just a few years. And one of the reasons is because when an employee of a small business gets sick or seriously injured, has high medical claims, then the insurance company, when that small employer's business comes up for renewal, they'll often jack the rates up so much that the small business has no alternative but to drop coverage. That is another reason why the number of people who are uninsured keeps growing. And these are all practices by the insurance industry, again, to avoid paying claims, and to and that makes more money available to reward shareholders. Regarding single payer, it has not been given serious consideration. There are, I think, maybe 80 co-sponsors on the House side of, I think it's H.R. 676 that's been introduced a number of times over the years, and it would create a system similar to what Canada has. a very simple piece of legislation, very few pages. I've read it. It's nothing approaching the 1,300 pages of H.R. 3200, which is the current major bill in the House right now. But the insurance industry has been very effective over the years in making sure that those the single-payer bills stay marginalized. And Senate Finance Chairman Max Baucus at one point said that it was not on the table, or it was not, and it was being perfectly honest. The leadership of the Senate and the House are not pushing single-payer, and that's just a tribute to the effectiveness of the health insurance industry.
And if we can just follow up on that, Mr. Potter, the with single-payer, any version of it being off the table, which would basically be the sort of system other democracies and industrial nations have, the plan, the sort of the reform plan is centered around the notion of a public option, which would leave the private health insurance companies, the giants, intact, but introduce now a public alternative that would compete with them and hopefully use their market power to force the corporations to serve consumers better. Do you think that's a fair assessment of what it would be, and do you think that's a solution?
It is a fair assessment. I think that's a very good way to describe it. I think the public option is certainly the best thing that we could possibly hope for. A lot of single-payer advocates are very skeptical and do not believe that it would do what needs to be done in terms of making health care affordable in this country. And they may be right, but it's about the best that we can hope for in terms of health care reform legislation this time. It was a central part of President Obama's plan when he was a candidate. It was a central part of Hillary Clinton's. It was a central part of John Edwards. It is a big part of the major House bill, H.R. 3200, that has not been voted on, but may be the ultimate plan or bill or something like it that's voted on by the House. It's essential if we have any kind of reform that is on the table right now. If the public option is carved out or dropped out, or if it's delayed by the so-called trigger that Senator Olympia Snow of Maine has proposed, then what we'll have largely is health care reform that will be a great big gift to the health insurance industry.
Let's go back to the phone lines right now to two callers who have been waiting patiently. Let's start, if we can, with line two. Urbana, you're on the air with Wendell Potter.
Thank you, Mr. Potter. I'm dealing with my mother, who has lifetime health insurance that she signed up that turned out to only be 2 years, and the company's called Conseco, which is an oxymoron because of the con in front of the name. And what they do to increase profits, we've learned, is that they say they're going to pay, but then they don't pay. And then the longer they do this across the board with all their the people who buy their premiums, the more profit they make. And anyways, I would like to hear your comment about that. And also I'd like to hear your comment about, thank you for turning your soul up a few notches and trying to inform, educate the public. I've seen you on Bill Moyers. I've seen you on Democracy Now. It's great. And I don't expect you to go on Rush Limbaugh or anything, but it would be really useful to go on, be in the media where you're not preaching to the converted. So I'd like to hear your response to that, and thank you for all the work you've done.
Well, thank you very much. Regarding your mother's insurance company, there are a lot of companies that sell policies that those who buy them find out ultimately are not there when they need them, and that is a growing problem, and not just smaller companies like the one you mentioned, but the big companies. There's a problem that Consumer Reports has pointed out through a lot of their work, and it didn't take a lot of investigative reporting to find out that a lot of companies sell what is referred to as junk insurance. I often call it fake insurance. You pay premiums. People don't really know exactly what the coverages are because people just don't really pay a lot of attention. If the premium seems to be affordable, you think you're getting a good deal. And if you get really sick, you find out that you've been paying premiums for insurance that is not really going to come anywhere close to covering your medical bills, and sometimes not at all. It sounds like what you and your mother are experiencing are delaying tactics, and that also goes on. Like the California Nurses Association statistics of the claim denials, often these claims could be, if they're appealed, the company would come around and pay them, but they often will deny them on the first round, hoping and thinking that people will just give up and think there's a legitimate reason why they were denied. So it's a delay. It's, you know, it's the delay and absolutely purposeful acts of trying to delay coverage by initial denials, and that goes on a lot. With regards to me and the news media, yeah, you're right. I was fortunate enough to be on Bill Moyers' Journal and Democracy Now. I've done a lot of interviews, mostly the ones that I've done that have been broadcast have been on MSNBC. I've been on almost all of their programs. I haven't been invited by Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck, and I don't know that I ever will, but I have actually been on a couple of Fox Business News segments. I will talk to anybody. I've been interviewed by a number of newspaper reporters, and so I'm hoping and trying to do all I can to be like I was when I was a journalist, to try to, at long last, to educate people and inform them about how the insurance industry really operates.
You know, Wendell Potter, I don't know if, I suspect almost every person listening to this program right now could call up with their own personal horror story of trying to deal with an insurance company, trying to get a claim paid. I certainly have a stack of my own, and most of my friends do in one way or another. And, you know, it's an industry that seems singularly disliked from my personal experience. I've seen no one jump to, what a wonderful group of folks there and what a great bang-up job they're doing. Yet when I see the news media coverage of this, of the healthcare policy fights over the past month or two, it seems like the corporate lobby has been able to set the agenda entirely. There's very little discussion of the conduct of the health insurance companies in the real world, the real situation Americans face, and almost entirely crazy stuff about killing grandma and stuff that has nothing to do with anything.
Yeah, you're right. It's a very sad commentary on the state of the U.S. media. You're exactly right. I've been very dismayed, and I benefited from the decline of the mainstream media in the United States when I was in my corporate job. As newsrooms shrank, a lot of the investigative journalists went away. There's very little investigative journalism compared to what there used to be, and the industry, as the balance between PR people and reporters continues to well, there's a great imbalance, and in fact, it gets worse and worse as years go by. Fewer reporters, far more PR people, like I used to be. And that has been a great disservice to American citizens, and I worry about the future of our democracy as this trend continues, and I see no reversing it. People don't get the news that they really need, and people gravitate toward the commentators that they might mistaken to be journalists, but they're just very opinionated pundits who are very easy shills of, or very willing shills of the health insurance industry, and even journalists who are with what I would call more legitimate media, with mainstream newspapers and with the TV networks, are failing us in the way they are covering this. They're not reminding us why we're having this debate in the first place. They're covering what's going on in Washington almost like a political contest, and it's sad to watch it.
Our guest, Wendell Potter. Let's go back to the phone lines again. We have a caller on line one. Champaign, welcome. You're on the air with Wendell Potter.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. A couple of comments and maybe a question or so. One, in terms of horror stories with the insurance companies, there's also horror stories in terms of the medical providers. I mean, it's my understanding both in this community with the duopoly we have here and elsewhere in the country that medical providers will tend to deny if they can get away with it or set tremendous hurdles to access to medical care if you're not properly insured or there's too much medical debt or if you're on Medicaid or so on and so forth. And I think Lisa Madigan has done something in this regard to this community, which to some extent I think because of the university and the fact that some of the university employees have adequate insurance, which I believe is probably paid for by the average taxpayer in some way, shape, or form, doesn't quite impact here as much as it could. But, okay, that's one question or comment. Two, when Obama uses the term uniquely American system, is your take on that that he's trying to thread a very thin needle between the insurance companies and what he'd like to do, or that he's been co-opted by the insurance companies? Three, it's my understanding that Glenn Beck made some sort of comment on the air that he'd like to choke Michael Moore or hire someone to choke Michael Moore. I think that's it's just a horrific comment to make. I would hate to think of what would happen to me if I were to make that type of comment about Glenn Beck on the air. And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Wendell Potter?
Yeah, your first observation about providers, you're right. Healthcare reform needs to be very broad, not just insurance reform. But the reason why we have to have insurance reform is because the insurance industry dominates and controls our healthcare system in so many ways, and in very perverse ways. Our multi-payer system that we have now creates what you described. A lot of doctors will try. Many doctors will not take Medicare or Medicaid patients, and they're free to do that. Some of them don't even take any insurance if they can avoid that. Hospitals will, if they can avoid it, will not admit someone who's uninsured. They'll do their best to provide to avoid running up a lot of uncompensated care. It's unavoidable, but the reality is that there is a lot of uncompensated care that's provided by providers, and it is because of this crazy financing system that we've got. It means that the average family premium is $1,000 more expensive than it ought to be just to cover the uncompensated care that providers, that hospitals provide to people who don't have insurance. So that's why healthcare reform should be broad based and not just attack the way we finance the system. But it is a reason why there's so much emphasis on health insurance reform. Obama and his use of the term uniquely American solution, yeah, that is a term that, like I said earlier, it's used by both opponents of reform, and I would put the health insurers in that category, even though they say they're for reform, and those who are advocating for it. It's a term that they think everybody thinks resonates well. And there has been a lot of focus group testing, and that is the kind of term that people like. That's what we're Americans. We think that we can create and design the best system on the planet because we just happen to be Americans. So that's where that's coming from. I think that I'm worried about what may ultimately be what the president is hoping to accomplish here. During the campaign, he was very strongly supportive of a public option. We've seen signals coming from the White House, the administration, that, well, maybe this is a small sliver of what reform should be, or maybe we should look at co-ops, or maybe we should look at a trigger to be in place before we create one. I'm really baffled by this. I do know that the administration has welcomed representatives from the special interests of the White House on a number of occasions, including some of the big CEOs from the health insurance industry. So I'm just not really sure what in the world is going on at the White House, but it concerns me. So I think all of us are going to be, at least not all of us, maybe not a lot of people maybe have healthcare reform fatigue, but now. But I think whatever the president says to Congress during the joint session next week bears a lot of watching. I guess later this week. Glenn Beck, what can you say about that guy? I think if many of us were to say some of the things that Glenn Beck is saying, getting away with on the air, I just can't believe what he is saying. But I guess he's found out he can say almost anything and get away with it, and a lot of people will believe it. I was at a town hall the other day at in Paterson, New Jersey, and it's abundantly clear to me that a lot of people turn turn on Glenn Beck Show and tune into Rush Limbaugh. That's where they get their information. They think these people are telling them the truth, and they don't realize that these people are the insurance industry shills.
Yeah, and if we could follow up on that point, because one of the things that was striking is I've been doing some research for this program, and it wasn't really something that striking in the sense that I didn't know it and or didn't sense it, is the degree to which the comments of politicians opposing health care reform of any kind, except rhetorically, there's just two or three or four talking points that come directly out of health, the corporate industry. Am I correct in that assessment?
Oh yeah, you're right, and they've been masters of language. They know how to use linguistics to their advantage, and they know which phrases will be effective. Yeah, so there are a few key messages, and they really understand the axiom of keep it simple, stupid, and they know that those messages, even if they're not true, most of them are not true, will be believed, and they'll scare people, and they are.
You know, as we talk about that, the other thing that occurs to me is that many of the arguments being used by the industry today to oppose any sort of reform of the healthcare system came up in the 40s, 50s, and 60s during earlier plans to do similar type measures by the government. And the most notable one was Medicare when it was passed in the 1960s, which the arguments against it were very similar to these. It would lead to socialism and the decline of the nuclear family and all sorts of crazy stuff. And now, since it's been passed, Medicare is like, you know, one of the most popular programs in the country, if not the most popular. Do you think, I mean, what is the lesson there?
Well, the lesson there is one I had thought that the Obama administration and leaders in Congress would have understood. Look at history. The opponents of reform are going to use the same tactics because they've worked every single time. It's fear mongering and simple messaging. I think that people, including people in high places in government, thought that, well, this time we're going to get it done because we've got a president who campaigned on reform. We've got large majorities of Democrats in the Congress. So the stars have aligned this time. I knew that the stars hadn't aligned. I knew the chances might be greater that we could get reform passed, but it was not going to be a walk in the park by any means. And I knew exactly what the insurance industry would be doing, and following the same playbook that it's followed and other opponents of reform have followed since the 40s, since the 50s and 60s, to kill reform. The special interest, and at times it's been the American Medical Association, it has been the American Hospital Association, the pharmaceutical industry, often they've aligned because their common enemy has been reform. And they've not liked different parts of reform, so it's been to their advantage to work collaboratively just to kill reform altogether. And that's happened many times right up until now.
Are there any times when you see the success of these corporate lobbies that you just, you were part of it, now you're witnessing it, and you see how they not only dominate the Republican Party, but key elements of the Democratic Party, that even with the immensity of this crisis and the substantial popular support for reform, that you just sort of think it's hopeless?
Well, yeah, I try to be an optimist, but it's harder and harder to be one. It's not new that this is happening. Of course, we've known the power of lobbyists for some time, but seeing it played out as I am seeing it played out again, and knowing how much money the insurance industry is throwing into this to try to kill reform or shape it. I'm not surprised, but I am just worried about the future of the country. We are approaching a country that is more of a plutocracy, I think, than people realize. You've got corporations so firmly in control of so much of our economy and our healthcare system that it's dismaying.
Our guest, Wendell Potter. This is Media Matters. Let's take a final caller now. Let's go to line one. Urbana, you're on the air.
Hi. You mentioned hospitals or doctors who might decline to accept a Medicare-funded patient. And that's one point. Next point is we often hear it stated that because Medicare reimburses at, say, just 80% of what a procedure actually costs. This makes me wonder, how does it determined by Medicare that, say, a hip replacement for an 80-year-old woman without diabetes should cost this much, and let's say a hip replacement for an 80-year-old with diabetes would cost this much? Can you talk about how these ballpark figures are arrived at and comment on whether or not it is true that Medicare does not pay what is acknowledged to be the full cost? Thanks.
Well, Medicare does pay a percentage of bill charges, and you're getting in an area that is very complex. Keep in mind that the true cost of care is subjective. It's not an easily defined term. One of the reasons why doctors charge what they do and hospitals charge what they do is because of our crazy reimbursement system. Doctors have to deal, if they do accept private insurance, most do, have to deal with the rules and regulations and requirements of a whole lot of different insurance companies. They almost always have to have some people who do nothing but be on the phone, requesting approval for something, or some prior approval, or contesting a claim denial or something like that. About 30% of what we spend in this country is wasted on administrative functions. That does not exist in other parts of the world. So I'm just mentioning this because it is one reason why healthcare costs are as high as they are. The other is something else I mentioned a few minutes ago, the cost of uncompensated care that the hospitals have to pass on some way or another, and that means that we're all paying for it. So all of this are contributing factors to why we have the most expensive healthcare system in the world.
Wendell Potter, we've only got about a minute left, and before we do go, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the Center for Media and Democracy, where you're presently located. Who are they, and why are you working with them?
I wanted to be affiliated with them, and I sought them out. They've done wonderful work over the time. John Stauber founded the organization several years ago, Wisconsin native. It is an organization that looks to try to inform people and journalists about the power and influence of people like I used to be, spin doctors, and to expose that and to educate people about the rise of public relations and the influence on the media and on our democracy.
Well, Wendell Potter, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. Just one final question. Are you optimistic for the coming months that we'll get some viable reform with the public option, or are you pessimistic?
You know, I'm optimistic. I really believe, and I'm hoping, that the president will stick to his gun and say we really need to have a public option, and Congress, let's do it and forget about the bipartisanship, because that's not going to get us where we need. A big part of this has to be insurance reform. A lot of what the insurance companies have done for many years should be made illegal. So I'm hopeful that we'll start in the right direction. It won't be what we really need, but maybe it'll be a big step in the right direction.
Well, Wendell Potter, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear us out of the studio. Thank you so much for taking time from your very busy schedule to join us here at Media Matters, and good luck with your work.
Thank you.
I'm Bob McChesney. Listeners, thank you very much. Please come back 167 hours. We're going to have Chris Mooney with us talking about the decline, even elimination, of science journalism and what that means for public policy in our lives. So have a great week, everyone. I want to thank Melissa Trentz, as always, for being a producer, and Kyle for working the board. Bye-bye.